Hello, listeners and viewers. This is the Healthy Intersections podcast for February 2024. I'm Lisa Lines, your host and the producer of this podcast. We are sponsored by the American Public Health Association Medical Care Section and the Medical Care Journal, and we're hosted on the Medical Care blog. Please check out the blog for today's podcast. There'll be all kinds of notes, really interesting background reading and other material. So don't forget to check out the medicalcareblog.com. And today on the podcast, we are continuing in our year of climate action. So all year this year, we're going to be talking about climate change and healthcare and public health and where those intersect and their relationships between those things among those different areas. So today on the podcast, I am delighted to have on the podcast today, David Intricazzo. David, welcome and thank you for joining us. Please tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure, Lisa. First, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it. So briefly, my background is I've been in DC for 25 plus years doing healthcare policy research, moreover, for the Congress, for several operational divisions at HHS, moreover, HRQ. I was for 7 years their evaluation officer, and then I've worked for a large number of clients, alphabetically ranging from the American Public Health Association to United Health Group. For the last 7 years, and exclusively over the last three, my work has been focused exclusively on climate crisis-related healthcare policy and helping providers reduce their scope 1 through 3 emissions. So that's briefly my background.
Okay, so you've already thrown in some interesting jargon, scope 1 through 3 emissions.
Right.
So would you like to tell the audience what that means?
This is reasonably straightforward. So in our case, we're talking about healthcare, same for all other industries. These are categorized 1 through 3. Scope 1 emissions are the emissions that you generate yourself. So, for example, hospitals typically have boilers for heating, and those emit carbon and other greenhouse gases. Scope 2 emissions would be every household, industry, otherwise, at least in the U.S., certainly has a utility company providing them electricity. So those are scope 2 emissions. And needless to say, healthcare consumes a good deal of electricity. And then scope 3 are supply chain emissions. So those are emissions from, in this instance, medical devices and supplies that providers purchase.
I see.
This gets more complicated because scope 3 you can throw in other categories. And in fact, according to the international standard, the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, there are 15 subcategories of scope 3 emissions. And I should say scope 3, again, referring to hospitals, is somewhere between 70% to 80% of a hospital's total emissions.
Wow. Okay. So the supply chain is a big piece of the
Correct.
Total picture. And
yes.
The healthcare industry in the U.S. being the GDP, I believe we take up about $1 in $5 in the U.S. So it's a huge industry. And as that is such a big industry, it has a very large footprint. So let's talk about the carbon footprint of the healthcare industry.
So you're right. U.S. healthcare is the largest industry in the world's largest economy. This year projected at $4.7 trillion, or as you said, 20% of the GDP. Interestingly, although the U.S. is just 4% of the world's population, U.S. healthcare roughly accounts for annually half of total global healthcare spending.
Wow.
U.S. healthcare is enormous.
Yeah.
And sadly, it is enormously energy inefficient.
Mm.
But before I explain how inefficient, I'll note the bottom line here is approximately 550 million metric tons of the term CO2e, carbon dioxide equivalent, greenhouse gases, is what the healthcare industry is accountable for annually.
Wow.
So the problem with this is that that number is for 2018 and was calculated by an academic. Mm. Sadly, the EPA does not calculate by industry sector, annual greenhouse gas emissions. So we're not crystal clear although we do know it's roughly five to say crudely 500 to 600 million metric tons. To give you an example, to sort of give you perspective rather, that's about 9% of total U.S. annual greenhouse gas emissions. It's 25% of total global healthcare greenhouse gas emissions. It's a very large footprint. If U.S. healthcare was its own country, it would easily fall in the top 10% of emitting greenhouse gas emitting nations.
Wow.
So it is a very large footprint. To note its inefficiency, the EPA for several years, over 20, offers a free software program called Energy Star, which mm-hmm. allows participants to calculate their annual energy use. The EPA scores usage. You could score between 0 and 100 as an Energy Star score. The higher the number, the more energy efficient you are. So the way it works is if you score 75 or above, you're considered Energy Star certified, which means obviously you're in the top quartile in energy efficiency. And this is just scope 1 and 2. Now, granted, not every healthcare provider participates in Energy Star. However, there are, per the AHA, American Hospital Association, about 6,000 U.S. hospitals. Last year, out of 6,000, not all of these participate, that point aside, but out of 6,000 U.S. hospitals, those participating in EP Energy Star, in 23, only 37 were Energy Star certified for energy efficiency. And again, that's just scope 1 and 2. So it gives you an idea of the amount of energy consumption and the level of inefficiency.
Tell me about some of the myths or misunderstandings that we have about this issue.
Sure. So there's a good deal of, I would call, false assumptions about when we discuss the climate crisis. We talk about human health, population health, public health. But in context of the climate crisis, really more coherently, we should talk about planetary health. That we should say that from that perspective, there's really only planetary health. Nature is a prerequisite. It's not a sector of society. So we can't be ourselves healthy if the environment is. That may seem like an obvious point. A few other points. The climate crisis, in fact, if you've read some of CMS's limited discussion in recent regulatory rulemaking, proposed rules under Medicare, you might be left with the impression that the climate crisis is a series of discrete catastrophes, disasters, or events. And those are the three words that they've used. That is definitively untrue. Every breath we take constitutes the climate crisis because ostensibly the entire world's population breathes substandard air as the result of fossil fuel combustion, particulate matter known as PM2.5. So the climate crisis is not a series of events. It's ever present, so we should be clear upon that. The other point, I'll leave it at one third point, and that the climate crisis is a meta problem. It exacerbates all healthcare problems. So absent mitigating it, you really can solve or improve healthcare. So beyond our human health and, say, extreme weather events and extreme heat, supercharged disasters, wildfires, it pollutes the air we breathe, and it exacerbates almost every health condition.
Yeah, and let's not depersonalize this. I mean, this is, we are polluting the air that we breathe.
Right.
The climate crisis isn't doing it. We are the climate crisis.
Yeah, right. We are. So that's why we're termed now it's the era is termed the Anthropocene era. We are entirely responsible, including people will make these sort of exceptions as if animals, which exhale methane, CH4, well, we breed these animals for consumption, right?
Right.
So that's our responsibility as
well. In huge quantities, yeah.
Yes, yes.
And driving a lot of deforestation and all of that. So
I should make this point. There are three treaties that were signed in 92 under the UN. There's the one we're discussing here, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on the Climate Crisis, the UNFCCC from 92. We signed it. But there were two other treaties. One is the Convention on Biodiversity, which, interestingly enough, the U.S. is the only country not to sign it. And then in that same year, there was a third treaty on desertification. So these latter two really don't get much discussion, but they're all part of a larger whole. So we should know all three of them.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's important. And this this issue, you know, it can feel overwhelming, but we're going to try and break it down and really get into step by step, bit by bit, where do we see opportunities for solutions, approaches to mitigate this issue? How can the healthcare industry turn from being a net negative on in terms of the climate crisis to a positive?
Certainly. It's been true for many years that there is the technology, the economics are increasingly improving. Really, the only thing we lack are the politics.
And so, yeah, the will.
The technology, renewable energy, and I can get into explaining why renewable energy is vastly superior to fossil fuels. The economics are vastly superior, in part because renewable energy is a technology. Fossil fuels are commodities.
Right.
And you can improve technology. You get what you get with a lump of coal. In fact, just for coal, the price of coal is actually the same when you factor in inflation. It's the same price it's been for over 100 years, in part because the more coal you consume, the deeper you have to dig the hole, the further you have to transport, right? Technology is constantly improving, which is why you see dramatic increases in cost efficiency as relates both to renewable energy sources and batteries.
Right. And you know, it's funny, here in California, the policies around rooftop solar, for example, have just been changed. They've decided that people who put solar panels on their roofs can no longer sell that energy back to the grid. And that gets rid of a whole heap of incentives and carbon credits and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's
funny. But, you know, that's
funny.
A political decision, right?
It is.
That's a political decision, yes.
It's policy, political determinants of all of this stuff. And, you know, we were talking in the last podcast about plastic pollution and how, you know, banning plastic, single-use plastic bags, or the intent was to ban them. But in fact, we ended up just with thicker, reusable plastic bags.
I saw that story just 2 days ago. Yes, yes.
Sometimes we shoot ourselves in the foot. That's very human of us. But here, let's really think about, let's tell our audience some of the things that healthcare sector people in healthcare, who presumably make up the bulk of our audience, what can we do? How can we move the needle on this?
Usually what you hear, either in the question or in the response, is this is a very complicated issue. I'd say at best or at worst, yes and no. I'd say largely it's not. The fundamental problem, the phrase, of course, is stop digging the hole, right? We have to stop consuming, burning oil and gas and coal. We have to delink our economy, macro, from using these commodities as fuel sources, right? So for healthcare, there's many opportunities. I'll get to the IRA in a second, but I do want to make this basic point. The healthcare industry, as we know, 20% of the GDP, is so large and its consumption is so significant that it can drive the market.
Yeah.
Okay, so the argument is, well, there's not the supply. Well, supply and demand are iterative, right? You don't have one without the other. So if the healthcare industry, the demand side, would drive this particular demand, the supply side would respond. Mm-hmm. So the argument that this industry particularly can't do anything, you know, it's downstream, it has to wait for the utilities and others. That's, let's just say, oversimplified or stated, okay?
We can't wait right. anymore. Right. The time is up.
So weak, in fact, I would say as it relates to supply chain, and I've said this in writing and publications, if the healthcare industry were to decarbonize the supply chain, the healthcare industry supply chain is so large, the ripple effects would go a long way in decarbonizing the entire economy's supply chain, which is why it's unfortunate that healthcare isn't, let's just say, doing a better job leading on this issue. The industry can drive supply because of its size of demand. The economics, as I said, of renewable energy are vastly superior. It's a technology, not a commodity. And would take a while to unpack this, but I think intuitively most people will get it. Renewable energy is abundant. You know, in fact, a Stanford professor calculated the amount of energy that the sun generates on a daily basis. It's vastly more than we'll ever need. So it's abundant. It's everywhere. Wind, solar, it's everywhere. It's light. It's not railroad cars of coal, et cetera. It's highly efficient. You know, the combustion engine is highly inefficient. So it's highly efficient, has zero marginal cost. It has increasing financial returns because, of course, the kilowatt hour prices are comparative to fossil fuels of just tanking and have in the last decade. And it distributes economic and political power equally. So we're no longer dependent on foreign sources of fuel, particularly noteworthy today, in fact, particularly noteworthy for the last several decades. And if you can have what's called island power, micro power, you're off the grid, you're not dependent on the grid, and that creates a certain amount of economic, beyond political, independence.
Yeah.
This administration, of course, we well know, has passed the Inflation Reduction Act. It has 40-odd tax credits, which are available to tax and tax-exempt entities alike, so nonprofit healthcare providers can leverage these tax credits as direct payments. I should also note that the IRA included $148 billion in direct appropriations to 16 departments, agencies, and councils. In the priority order, it was Ag, DOE, EPA. Interestingly, HHS got no money, but I note that $150 billion because those monies are being used in grants and other programs by these departments and agencies to further the effort. Probably most noteworthy is the EPA has what's called the Green Bank, Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund more formally. That's $27 billion. And a lot of that money, about half of it, is being used for solar power. Let me just stay on solar power relative to a specific prior question. Clearly, there's a revolution, not to the extent there is in China relative to solar installations. In fact, last year, China installed more solar power than the U.S. has in its entire history.
Wow.
Of course, much bigger country, larger population. But there isn't a dramatic increase in solar power in the U.S. beyond the affordability from the additional affordability from tax credits. And there's all sorts of other opportunities to lower installation costs or build-out costs, sometimes termed or formerly termed CapEx costs. There is something in 43 states have it, 20 plus states have enabling legislation, something called community solar, which the healthcare industry, in fact, I was just on the phone this afternoon with HRSA on this. I spoke with the DOE 2 days ago about this. The DOE supports community solar. There is a significant opportunity for healthcare providers to decarbonize via solar, particularly community solar. Fairly qualified health centers, community health centers are really going down the road on this. The White House is cheering this. California, you would guess Puerto Rico for the obvious reason. So those are too likely. But this is really proving to be beyond just solar. There are two types per the regulations. There's emergency power. So it's more than just solar for emergency power and extreme weather events. There's enough power being generated for what's termed alternatively essential power, which is your day-to-day power use. And so these solar installs are being used for both at the community health center, FQHC level. There's optimism, particularly as it relates to community solar's use. So there's a lot more that could be said about this, but I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's huge. And if nothing else, you know, that's the easy way to address your emissions is rooftop solar for sure.
Beyond sort of the reducing greenhouse gas emissions, there's financial advantages because the pricing is less. In fact, just as an aside, there's a study published about 14 months ago that looked at 200 operating U.S. coal plants. And the study concluded with the exception of one operating coal plant, it would be cheaper to decommission the remaining 199 and build from scratch solar or wind.
Wow.
So just to give you an idea of how much more affordable. So beyond the finance, beyond the reduction in greenhouse gas, and the financing is and the economics are superior, and of course there's the environmental sustainability aspect as well. You're also improving, of course, quality of care for your patients because now these are avoided emissions, and of course you're improving timeliness of care because say, an example of an extreme weather event, you don't necessarily have to close, as was the case with Hurricane Sandy. Diesel-powered emergency in New York City, these generators were underwater. So these hospitals had to close for weeks. You can avoid all that.
Right, yeah. Well, that's hope-inspiring. So what else? How else can the healthcare industry reduce its carbon footprint?
I'm going to make 2 points. The first I can easily just note. The industry, if you look, and I have to note this, everyone should be reading the annual Lancet Countdown Report on Climate and Health. It comes out in November. The 8th annual was out this past November. I note it because quantitatively, they provide a good deal of data, 40-odd pages, but they show that the healthcare industry, unlike other major industries, has not divested in fossil fuels.
All right.
So there's a opportunity that the healthcare industry is really not comparatively taken advantage. The other opportunity is accounting. So the healthcare industry has also, unlike other large industries, has not really comparatively publicly reported their greenhouse gas emissions, or just more generically done sustainability reporting. So for example, there could be, to put it politely, greater participation. I note hospitals because they're the largest in healthcare, they're the you could guess intuitively, they're the largest healthcare polluting silo, and about 35-36%. Pharmaceuticals are next. So hospital participation in EP Energy Star could be better, let's just put it way. Hospitals do participate, but they don't public report their scores. I've argued in an article in 21, almost 3 years ago, argued that they should require public reporting of hospitals' EP Energy Star scores under conditions of participation, as a requirement of participation.
I mean,
it would
Medicare
be an easy lift. It's because it basically means it's hitting one software, it's hitting one button for the EPA software program to run. Hospitals are already participating, it's really no more work. Right. So public reporting is critical, it's key, which is why the Security Exchange Commission has this pending rule, because that's all about public disclosure. The motivation under the SEC, and just to digress, is because financial asset managers, investors want to know, particularly as capital intensive as healthcare is, they want to know what their climate exposure is. Are they in a flood zone? How resilient are they? How adaptable are they? What's their footprint? Because that helps them decide financing. Should we loan and at what interest rate? But not to digress, beyond Energy Star reporting, which is scope 1 and 2, the industry ought to adopt standard greenhouse gas protocol accounting. Now, the secretary 2 Earth Days ago promoted a pledge where you can voluntarily sign up for the climate pledge. And the pledge meant that you're going to do a few things. This year, if you pledge, this year you're supposed to conduct a scope 3 inventory. But the pledge was that you were going to reduce your emissions per the Biden goal 50%. By 2030. But the problem with the pledge is, and you could say, and I've said, it constitutes greenwashing because they're not required to use any standard metrics. There's no guidelines. It's just basically on faith. Well, you can't publicly report credibly unless you're using a guideline or a standard or a metric. That internationally is the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, particularly, say, per California, because you now have the climate accountability package, right, that was signed by your governor a few months ago, that all these public disclosures the SEC will have, ESRD and the EU has it, all has an assurance provision, which means that if you're going to publicly report, you have to follow a guideline or a standard so that the public has assurance that you're just not making it up.
Right.
Right. So basically, another way to say it is that whatever you're public reporting, some third party has to be able to audit to say, we get the same answer you do, right? So beyond divesting, really the bigger issue is sustainability accounting for the purposes of public reporting, because public reporting, as Hill Centers like to say, sunlight is the greatest disinfectant, right? So if it's publicly reported, this creates public pressure to decarbonize consumers or patients. And we do know already that staff, clinicians, are very interested in knowing to what extent their employer, hospital, whatever other provider is addressing, you know, its emissions pollution. Also, just to note or reemphasize, public reporting sooner or later is going to be required regulatorily. Whether it's the SEC rule, there are other states considering adopting the California, Oregon, Colorado, New York. There are 50 subnational jurisdictions, cities, Washington's other states like Washington that are requiring some form of public disclosure complemented by some reporting relative to reductions in emissions. So Boston's got BARDO, New York's got its ordinance, Chicago has its. You can probably guess where else. But these are becoming increasingly in number. And the sooner there's the learning curve and the practice, the better for everyone.
Yeah, and the time has long passed, right? We can't wait any longer. We have to, all of us, get on the train, decarbonize, electrify everything, and go solar.
I'm glad you said the time has passed. We talked earlier, Lisa, and I made the comment, this has become largely a history lesson. You know, 90% of the problem is already in the atmosphere relative to 1.5 average warming. Keep in mind, carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere upwards of 1,000 years. And I should also note relative to healthcare, which is a particular problem. So according to the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, there are 7 greenhouse gases and categories of gases. The EPA is only define a social cost for 3, N2O, CH4, and CO2. But healthcare uses anesthetic gases, and this is noteworthy. The listeners probably aren't aware, but there's something called the GWP. It's the global warming potential, and the global warming potential is scored against carbon. So if you have twice the warming potential of CO2, you're going to get a score of 2. So because CO2 gets a GWP of 1, right? That's this scale. DES or diesel fluorine is a popularly used anesthetic gas in the U.S. It has some clinical superiority compared to other gases. The global warming potential diesel fluorine is 2,540.
Wow.
Now it doesn't exist in the atmosphere as long, but it has a massively greater GWP, which means a more potent warming effect. It traps more. This gets at the chemistry and molecular level. So it's for healthcare, nobody else really uses diesel fluorine, right? So it's a particular problem for healthcare. And we really don't have, I mean, there's this awareness. I give it the credits due to the anesthesiologists and that school of medicine. Their efforts to try to reduce its use, use more IV anesthetics. So their efforts, scavenging, you know, just not as much released. Just so the listeners know, when a patient inhales, it doesn't metabolize the gas. They just exhale basically the same thing they inhaled. So it's emitted into the atmosphere, which is why it's so potent and problematic. But that is a particular uniqueness and concern and worry for healthcare.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing all of your wealth of information about this incredibly important topic. I wonder if you have any last thoughts, closing thoughts, just to put a ribbon on it, tie a bow, wrap it up for us.
Well, I will say, so we talked about the industry, just to make a comment about policy. The Biden administration in 21 came out with the tackling, that was their verb, climate crisis in an executive order. It was going to be a whole of government effort. Unfortunately, during this administration, 4 years, HHS will not promulgate a single Medicare, Medicaid-related, climate-related regulation.
They
talked about it early on, but there are no final rules. And if you think about this, not just decarbonizing, but as it relates to care delivery, we don't have anything climate crisis-related to risk adjustment, quality measurement, pay for performance, or performance-based payment, however you want to term that. So those are opportunities, to say the least. Unfortunately, to be polite, not surprisingly, Medicaid and Medicare beneficiaries are disproportionately harmed by greenhouse gas pollution. the frail elderly, you could guess, young children, you know, their lungs aren't developed, their immune system, so it's not a surprise. So relative to regulating Medicare and Medicaid providers, it's particularly important that this gets addressed. And unfortunately, it has not. So from a regulatory legislative perspective and from the perspective of taxpayers supporting social insurance for these populations, they pay the highest climate penalty. The other point I'll just make generically, if I was to wrap this all up for the listeners as a, for an understanding of this, I would say the problem is we've confused effectiveness with efficiency. Effectiveness meaning how quickly are we reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the healthcare sector? How effective are we in that stop digging the hole? Instead, we're more concerned with efficiency. And I mean, the IRA is all sticks, no carrots, with the exception of one carrot for methane gas. So we talk about efficiency as it relates to efficiency in financing, which is what explains the tax credits. And that's not irrelevant, but more on point is measuring to what extent is the industry reducing its, again, 550 million tons CO2e annually. I mean, that's really all that matters. I would say to listeners that this affects everybody because everybody's involved in forwarding the industry. I will say, too, that at $4.7 trillion, and the estimate is about 25% is spent without improving anybody's health status. So if we have $1 trillion washing around, I think we have more than enough to improve performance via reduction and elimination of industry's emissions.
Yeah, that's a very powerful point. And thank you so much for being so clear and clear-headed about how important this is. And, you know, listeners, I again encourage you to go to our blog, the blog post for this podcast. We'll have all kinds of notes and further reading. I also just want to say you have your own podcast, David. So tell the listeners about how they can find more of your words.
Thank you. Thank you for the promotion. So for 12 years, I've produced the Healthcare Policy Podcast. It's now on Substack. I'm about to do my 300th interview. There are about 40 climate crisis-related podcasts that I've conducted. In fact, just last week, I interviewed University of St. Thomas Engineering Professor John Abraham as relates to ocean heat content or rapidly rising ocean temperatures, which really explain most of this subject and problem. So probably in healthcare, you've unfortunately not heard about this OHC, salinity, acidification of ocean water. But as the oceans go, so we go. So it's an important aspect relative to health. In fact, I've interviewed him now 3 Januaries in a row.
Wow. Very important to get that message out there. We can't keep treating the oceans and the air like an open sewer.
That's Al Gore's line. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. So with that, I want to thank you again, David, for coming on to the podcast today. And listeners, thank you for your time and attention. And please spread the word and let's turn the tide and make something happen.
Yes, let's. Thank you so much, Lisa, for the opportunity.